Welcome, everyone, to today's Cluin Internet Seminar, entitled NARPM Presents Institutional Controls. Today's session has been scheduled by the U.S. EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Jean Valance, and I work in that very same office, and I'll be helping to moderate today's session. We'll get the technical presentation started in just a minute, but while we're waiting for a few others to join us on the line, I'm going to cover a couple of basic housekeeping items. Again, if you haven't done so already, you'll need to get a copy of the presentation materials open in front of you. So when you registered for today's session, you would have seen a confirmation message as well as been directed to the seminar homepage. And on that homepage, you're able to look at the date, the time, a description of today's events, contact information for our presenters as well as myself, and you'll have options to either go to the seminar, which is a button that appears on the left of the side of the homepage, which will allow you to pull up the slides in a web browser window. Or at the lower part of that same page, you could download a copy of the slides as either PowerPoint or PDF. So I'm going to direct everybody to have a copy of those materials open. And from that, I'm going to ask you guys to move on from slide number one to slide number two. And if you haven't figured it out, you will be doing exactly what we just did. Each individual participant will manually move through the materials at verbal cues from our presenters today. So again, we're on slide number two, which is covering housekeeping items. If you're on the phone lines, please keep your phone on mute. You can use your own mute button or hit star 6 to mute your line. At the appropriate times for questions, those of you on the phones who wish to ask a question out loud will be able to unmute your phone. But until we get to those breaks, I want to be sure that everybody stays muted. Don't put the call on hold. There could be background music or commercials that will be disruptive. Simply hang up and you can dial back in without disrupting the line. So again, stay muted until time for Q&A using your own mute button or hitting star 6. Those of you that are streaming the audio online, you don't have to worry about a mute option from you. But if you have any comments, questions, or technical problems, you can actually type up your comments or questions at any point in time using some of the icons that appear along the top of your slides. Individuals looking at the slides online through a web browser window will see numbered links appearing to the left-hand slide. And you can click on the links to jump to the appropriate slide. Again, we're on slide number two. Or you can use the icons that are located at the top of the slide, orange buttons. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. If your pop-up blockers have been disabled, if you click the question mark icon along the top, a new window will open up, which will allow you to type up electronic comment or question, which I will then read on your behalf to the presenters to answer at the appropriate time. You don't have to wait to a break for Q&A to do that. You can enter those questions or comments at any point, and in fact, we would encourage you to do that in advance. That way, we'll have a nice question queue to go through when we take our breaks for questions. A reminder for everybody, today's session is being recorded and will be archived. You will automatically receive an email from me as soon as that archive is available, which usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks. If you want to look at our other existing seminars, you can take a look at our current archive page, which has almost 430 different events from over the years. This is also the first seminar in an entire series that will be offered throughout 2012 from the NARPM Presents series. So if you do like today's session, just come back to Cluin and take a look at our training calendar to see what else NARPM Presents has in store. I believe that is the end of the reminders that I have for everybody. When we're done today, we'll have a short feedback form that will prompt you to fill out, as well as provide information on how you can download a copy of the presentation and a number of other related resources. But we'll get to that when we close out today. So I think those are the end of the reminders, and it's 1:04, so I'm going to officially introduce our two presenters for today's session. Again, we're being joined by Sherry Bakken, from U.S. EPA Region 5, and Dante Rodriguez from U.S. EPA Region Number 9. And again, they'll be here to join us to talk on the NARPM Present session on institutional control. So with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 3, and I will officially turn things over to Sherry and Dante.
Hi, this is Dante Rodriguez calling from San Francisco, California. It's a sunny, bright day, and we're having a good time so far. I am a Superfund Remedial Project Manager here in the Region 9 EPA office. I'm also the Institutional Controls Coordinator for our regional office and a member of the National EPA Institutional Controls Work Group. Joining me today is Sherry Bianchin, Sherry from Chicago. How's it going, Sherry?
Okay, Dante, thanks. It's a little chilly here, though, so sorry to say that it's good to be inside today. I am also an RPM and on the National Work Group, I've worked for USEPA for 28 years, and I've been an IC coordinator for going on 8 years. Wow, that's a long time. So I'm going to have everyone turn to the next slide, which is, I guess, slide 4, and I'm going to go briefly through the agenda of what we hope to achieve through our webinar today. And just a little plug for our National Association for Remedial Project Managers. This presentation, we're actually kind of given some tidbits that were presented at the 2011 NARPM conference last year. And so Dante and I are kind of presenting some of the highlights. So that's where this information was presented, and there will be another presentation in the 2012 NARPM conference, which I'm not sure if it's been announced yet, but I understand it's going to be held later this year.
I heard that it's going to be in Henderson, Nevada, Sherry.
Okay, sounds good.
In October, after the first of the fiscal year.
That's really good. So, again, going through the agenda, briefly we're going to talk about some resources that are available to Superfund employees working on Superfund sites and contacts, and also for the public and other private entities who have burning IC questions. We're going to provide some of that information. Dante's going to talk a little bit about IC on tribal lands, which is a hot issue right now for our agency. We're going to highlight some of our recent guidance documents on ICs, including one that's pretty much hot off the press from last fall. Talk more about our national work group and how you might be able to get involved in that, and then highlight on some of the EPA collaboration with local government.
I noticed, Sherry, that Gene said that there's people from all over the world. So I think that means that we have people from outside the agency. So you and I will probably have to define a few terms here and there and not use so much lingo.
Okay, please keep me honest on that one. 28
okay.
Years, I get too much with the acronyms. So I think I'm going to have everyone turn to the next slide now, slide 5, I believe. And the first thing I wanted to point out is some of our headquarter contacts, who you would definitely want to know these folks. James Miles, who's one of our co-leader of our national work group, and Chip Love, and they're both co-leaders of our national work group. So if you ever really need to not know who to talk to, you would start with our headquarters contacts and talk to James or Chip.
James is an attorney with our enforcement division in headquarters, and Chip is with the Superfund program office.
And then also there's a list of our regional contacts and other headquarter contacts that we posted on the website. So if you wanted to go and pull that down after the webinar, you could do that, and you could keep that handy. Or if you are an EPA employee, it's on the intranet site that's posted there. That intranet site is not available outside of EPA buildings, so you might have to go ahead and just pull it down from the Cluin website.
Now, Gene, can you confirm that attachment was loaded up and available for all the participants?
Yes, I can. That type of attachment will be available on the additional resources page that people can get to when we're done today.
Great.
Okay, so why don't we move on to slide 6, 2004 IC strategy.
That's the whole beginning of everything, wasn't it?
That is taking us back a while, but this is when EPA made sure that we were firming up a strategy to ensure that institutional controls are implemented at our sites. And I think the statistic is something like 90% of our Superfund NPL sites require some type of institutional controls.
So were we not doing institutional controls at all before 2004, Sherry?
We were doing them, but we were really building our remedies more back in the day of the early time of Superfund. And now we're really getting to the point where we got to get those 5-year reviews completed and protective remedies and construction complete, and we want to make sure that we don't lose anything with those ICs being in place. One thing I wanted to point out, just a little terminology here, the 2004 IC strategy actually came up with sort of process to make sure that we were all communicating on the national level, and that's how the IC work group became established. And the strategy said that there was going to be management representatives, which we call MAGIC, our Management Advisory Group for Institutional Controls. So we have some MAGIC in these ICs. That strategy also required a program and legal coordinator in each region. So that's how Dante and I got involved in this. And in each region, there will be at least one IC program and legal coordinator. So those are good folks to get to know and contact in case information you need some information or have some questions or issues. Anything else you want to say about that, Dante?
I'd like to point out that the 2004 Institutional Control Strategy really honed in on a couple of key points. One was that sites where we left waste in place above a level or above a concentration that would allow for unrestricted use of the resource, unrestricted use of the groundwater or unrestricted use of the land, those would be places where we would need institutional control. That was one of the key facets of the strategy. The second key facet of the strategy was that there's a lot of sites out there and that we would focus first on those sites that had already been construction complete, and we would go back and have everybody in all the regions review those sites and make sure that we had institutional controls in place at places like that where there was waste left in place above an unrestricted use level. And if not, we would work to get those in place right away. So the 2004 strategy did a couple things, that being one, and then the second one being establishing ongoing work groups and communication lines.
So it was a sort of prioritization of the workload that we were facing at the time. And I think we've come a long way, too, since the start of the strategy. Another aspect of the strategy was that we needed to come up with a tracking system. And that was sort of the birth, I guess, of the Institutional Control Tracking System, or the ICTS, which we are now on the Tier 2 version of that. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. So anything else on that, Dante?
That's all.
Let's move on to slide 7. How about that? Okay, some of the national work group topics.
So these are the things that the national work group is working on right now. Topics sometimes come and go. Sometimes we will be faced with a brand new issue that starts coming up, and whenever that happens, it goes to the work group, and we share information across the regions and whatnot, and headquarters acts as kind of a key middle person who gets all this types of information and helps share it. The IC on tribal land being one of the topics that has come up just in the last couple of years as a significant issue, and so a subgroup was formed to start looking into that. And like Sherry said, the IC tracking system is something that we've been working on ever since 2004.
One of the topics that has been a concern of ours from the inception of getting ICs in place was this concept of what do we do about those landowners who aren't cooperating with us? And we put that in quotes, uncooperative landowners. And those landowners could be innocent landowners where contamination has come to be located at their property and they had nothing to do with the original site or property or problem. Or it could be a responsible party's land who were also trying to get those ICs in place. So we've been sort of grappling with our approach on these types of landowners, and we do differentiate between the types of landowners. And we're putting together some Q's and A's about how to address these questions and issues as they arise. The most important thing that we've kind of come to consensus is that whenever a landowner is to put ICs on their property, and they would be the ones to do that, we want to be sure as an agency that we're giving them the proper notice and that they understand why the ICs are important. So there's an education component there that we are responsible for, and to make sure that our decision documents are articulating that, so they had a chance to review that in their public comment. And then also, though, if we aren't getting cooperation, what type of escalating actions do we want to take to ensure that we get those ICs in place so we have protective remedies?
So Sherry, is there some kind of a guidance on this that's available for people?
There is nothing yet. If anyone has some burning questions right now, they can contact their IC coordinator or headquarters. But I understand there will be some guidance or Q&As coming out fairly soon. So that's what I know about that topic. Next topic, ICs at vapor intrusion sites. There's a work group working on vapor intrusion sites, and ICs are a component of that. So that's sort of being worked on right now. If anyone out there has any questions about vapor intrusion sites, we'd be happy to kind of address those offline. This is evolving. And also, if anyone has any ICs at vapor intrusion sites, we're very interested in finding out about those, too, and how that's working.
Another topic that the National Work Group has some folks working on is model inserting institutional control requirements into our model standard boilerplate consent decrees and consent decree scopes of work. These are obviously for PRP lead sites, ones where the polluters are leading the cleanup efforts and under EPA's oversight, of course. And a consent decree is a typical settlement agreement between EPA and the responsible parties that lays out what they're going to do and all that kind of stuff. And so we have model boilerplate consent decrees that everybody uses. And so now institutional controls has been inserted into that. And we had a group of folks do that. And the boilerplate scope of work is still under construction. Finally, we have an ongoing topic. I wouldn't say it's we have a subgroup necessarily, but we have an ongoing topic where we're looking at different examples of how people work with local government and local governmental controls and jurisdictions and whatnot to implement institution controls in different parts of the country. And so we actually have some discussion and some case studies towards the end of this presentation, where we'll be talking about different examples of local governmental controls. So that's actually a very interesting topic, and we're always getting new examples of how people do it at Superfund sites around the country.
So why don't we turn to the next slide, which is slide 8. And just a little bit more about our national work group. We do meet monthly as needed. Is it the third Thursday that our work group meets, Dante?
Well, sometimes it's either once a month or once every other month. Something like that, yes.
Yeah, and so if anyone wanted to come onto our work group and bring a question forth either to us as coordinators and headquarters to answer, we could bring it forth and then get back to you, or if you want to even get on the call and ask the questions. We have a lot of very knowledgeable people with different experiences who are always happy to help. So that's one thing we wanted to tell you. And, you know, our purpose is to share information and address novel issues and just kind of help people hopefully come to some good practical solutions for some of these questions that are coming up. And sometimes we, as Dante said, we develop our sub-work groups for some issues that take a little bit longer thought to get to some answers.
And anybody, even, you know, folks from outside of EPA can certainly contact the EPA regional institutional control coordinator with a question, and know that the IC coordinator for your local area has this work group behind them, and they will share your question with all of us, look for examples, you know, get people from headquarters' input and stuff. And so it is a really good resource for folks within and outside of EPA.
So I think we'll turn to the next slide now, slide 9. And, Dante, you're going to talk a little bit more about institutional controls in Indian Country, correct?
That's correct. Now, Sherry mentioned earlier that this presentation that we're giving today is from what was presented at the last National Conference of Remedial Project Managers, and the folks who had put together these various slides are, well, we tried to give the reference and give them credit for it, so you know we're not just plagiarizing their stuff, although it is government property, so intellectual property, I'm sure. So Cecilia De Robertis is in headquarters, the enforcement office, and she is on a subgroup that about 2 years ago was tasked with looking into the question of how to do institutional controls on Indian lands. It was just coming up at the time, and so this presentation was given by Cecilia last May at the last conference, and it represented what she had gathered at that time. If we talk to her today, she may have further developed information and could give a even better update, but this is what we had at the time. And I think there was very few Superfund sites that had started working on this issue, and so she is definitely the right person to talk to if anybody has issues with this sort of thing. I'll be giving, you know, my best effort at describing what Cecilia told us, but I certainly am not an expert in this topic of Indian Country law. Now, the basic issue here is that typical state real estate property law does not apply on Indian lands because Indian lands are not technically part of the state. So therefore, the typical most common institutional control, which is a proprietary control, is really different when you look at Indian lands. Now, a proprietary control, for those unfamiliar, is a property interest that the government is able to secure in order to basically put restrictions on the use of the property. That's the most basic rough description of what a proprietary control is. It's similar to when somebody procures an easement on a property for a utility line or something like that, and the person who then owns that easement owns a certain right on that property. So that's what a proprietary control is when EPA or the state government gets a property interest on the property.
What slide would you be on at this point?
Same one,
okay. 10?
Now, go to the next slide, slide 10, of land ownership. See, land ownership, this table describes different types of land ownership on Indian lands. Okay. It could be a piece of land within an Indian land. It could be trust land, which means it's held, the title of it is held by the U.S. government in trust for the benefit of the tribe or a particular tribal member. Okay, so the United States holds that interest. Or you could have restricted fee land, which is where the tribe itself or a tribal member holds title to the property with subject to some restrictions with regards to alienation, which means if they're not, because if they lose their tribal membership, they would lose their property or title to their property. The third thing is fee simple, which is legal title held by tribe itself, tribal member, or somebody not a tribal member. So it could be anybody without restrictions. So that's contrasted with the restricted fee land, restricted fee land, it has to be a tribe or tribal member. Fee simple is that it does not have to be tribe or tribal member. So that gives you kind of an overview of how property ownership law typically works on Indian land. Now, turn to the next slide where we focus in on proprietary controls as institutional controls. When one wants to do a proprietary control on Indian land, what are the advantages and disadvantages and how might it work? Well, the advantage is that the title needs to be reviewed whenever anybody's going to take out a mortgage on the property or a lease for mining or timber type activities. And a title review is the same thing that one typically does in any other part of the state. Whenever you're buying a piece of property, you go to your title company and have them go down to, you know, the county records, and they give you a title report saying, you know, here's everybody who's owned it, here's everybody who has an interest in the property. They give you a whole report on the history of the property and all that stuff.
And that's what's typically called a title commitment in the real estate market.
Title commitment report. So one does need to do a title review when on Indian land you're doing a mortgage or a lease for natural resource extraction. Another advantage, of course, is that proprietary control is tied to the land and will stay with that piece of land through various ownerships as the land is transferred. Finally, the other big advantage is that the Bureau of Indian Affairs is technically responsible for managing that, and we can enforce against them if there's any kind of problem or any kind of breach of a existing proprietary control. The disadvantages, however, are that A, land is actually rarely transferred in Indian territories, and even if it is, the Bureau of Indian Affairs land offices are actually pretty few and far between, making it difficult to do a title search. And even if you go and find the land office, the offices are reportedly to typically be in some stage of disarray, where they're making it difficult, even if you wanted to do a title report, to actually do a title report. And finally, even if you do have a proprietary control and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, even if they recognize that it's properly executed and everything, they have a hard time controlling anybody's actions on the land. So those are the disadvantages, which, depending on the situation, may outweigh the advantages, etc. So what's a better institutional control, perhaps, in many situations? Turn to the next page and you'll find out. Governmental controls. Governmental controls are another type of institutional control whereby we rely on a different level of government, be it state or local, county, city, or in this case, an Indian tribal government, to execute an institutional control. They'll do it in a number of ways. A local jurisdiction might pass an ordinance. A state might pass a regulation that restricts use of a resource, be it groundwater, surface water, or activities on the land. Any of that can be done in a tribal setting as well. The advantage of doing that is that you would be utilizing the tribe and their legal processes that are already in place. It empowers the tribe to be a steward of the land, of course, and it's more likely that somebody doing an activity on the tribal land would go through the tribe's own legal permitting type processes, and therefore the institutional control would actually be more effective. A disadvantage, however, is that the tribe, even if they agreed to put a governmental type institutional control in place, they could change it anytime they wanted. And EPA doesn't have any enforcement authority to withhold that control itself. It's entirely dependent on the tribe's legal processes. Another disadvantage is that it would be resource intensive for the tribe to continue to monitor and implement that control. However, it is, though, within their typical legal processes, and so this governmental control type institutional control does appear to have more advantages than a proprietary control in the tribal setting. Move to the next slide, and we'll talk a little bit about informational devices. Now, EPA does consider informational devices as a type of institutional control. It's certainly not as legally strong as a proprietary control or a governmental control, because an informational control is you're just trying to get information out to people that tells them that such and such area or such and such resource is not safe for XYZ use. And you're relying just on education to influence people's actions. However, it is recognizably a useful thing to do. And the advantage is that it's very adaptable to different situations and cultural needs on a tribal setting. And it's easy to do multiple layers of informational devices. Like, you can have warning signs, and you can have general outreach and education in a particular area or community and stuff like that. So you can do a lot of different things to make everybody aware of a unsafe situation. Of course, like I said, they're not enforceable. You're not requiring people to do it. And another disadvantage in a tribal situation is that a tribe may be reluctant to undertake it and to tell people something's not safe, or if they have some kind of cultural activities or sacred activities that they typically do within a certain resource area, and where somebody's trying to tell them not to, then that could be a difficult situation to implement. And as with any informational control, there is difficulty in monitoring them and knowing exactly how many times somebody disregarded the warnings and went ahead and became exposed to a contamination situation. Finally, to summarize this difficulties with informational type devices as institutional controls is that it's hard to force culture on any group of people and change their way of doing things. It would take a lot of educational effort, probably over a long period of time, to get people to change their ways. And so that would not be something that you could rely on to have an immediate effect.
And the most common type of informational device would be the fish advisory. And so that would be, the same concerns would be private lands and Indian country. the same concerns exist, but there are different concerns on tribal lands, as you mentioned, about the culture and the sacred activities that a tribe might feel this interferes with.
Right. There is one more type of institutional control, and that's enforcement controls. Enforcement controls are ones where EPA uses its direct enforcement authority to either order or sign a consent decree, a two-party mutual agreement, where the other parties agree to certain restrictions or restricted activities or uses on a particular property. Now, the advantage of doing this is that we can work directly with whoever owns that property and whoever has activities going on that property to get them to agree to these restrictions. And that's usually a reasonable way to go when you have a limited number of parties involved in activities on that property. If you have just one property owner and they control it, if, you know, they have a business there or what have you, and they agree to not do certain things or not dig a certain soil areas or whatever, then that's a fairly reliable thing because you can monitor that one party. However, it could get greatly complicated if there's multiple property owners and a lot of different activities going on the property. In the Indian land type setting, it may require a memorandum of agreement with the tribal government in order to establish an enforcement type control. It depends on the situation. Now, a disadvantage of enforcement control is that it only applies to the party that you ordered or that you signed up with. If they sell the property, then it's an entirely new owner that you would then have to go and renegotiate or issue a whole new order, and you as the EPA or state government overseeing this need to constantly be watching for property transfers. And so that's a more cumbersome control in the long term. Another disadvantage when you're dealing with tribal land is that you might have some political issues if you think you're going to be able to order the tribe to do something. Typically, that would not sit too well, and so depending on the situation, that could come up, political issues with implementing an enforcement type control. That is go ahead and move to the next slide. That's the summary of what Cecilia reported at the last conference. And here's her contact information. If you have any questions or want to pick her brain on things or run some ideas by her or whatever. So, actually, Sherry and I would be happy to try to answer anybody's question that we could at this time with regards to institutional controls on Indian country.
Okay. Let's start with those of you on the phone lines. If you're on the phones and you have a question for Sherry or Dante, you can take yourself off of mute by either using your own mute button to unmute or hitting #6. And we'd ask that you simply identify yourself and your organization before asking your question.
Question?
Okay, I don't hear anybody on the phone right now. I do have a number of questions that were typed up electronically, so I'll go ahead and read some of those out loud to you. The first question is coming in from, I believe, Alaska, and they ask, is one of the work groups focusing on the need for ICs on off-site properties where contamination is present above action levels?
On-site versus off-site, tends to be a two common terms that have different definitions depending on who's talking about it. In the Superfund context, anywhere that where the contamination is come to be located is considered on-site. Other times, people will be talking about on-site as the original property where the old, you know, release occurred. But according to the Superfund law, that's not the definition that we use. So therefore, in your question, where you're talking about the contamination got off-site, I would say it got off-property, perhaps, but EPA still has the ability to implement institutional controls in those areas that are off-property where the contamination has come to be located. Now, that could, of course, there's a number of issues that come up with that, one being property owners who didn't have anything to do with causing the contamination. And like Sherry was saying earlier, we do have a work group that's working on how to deal with property owners who may be uncooperative in that situation. So in that regard, yes, we have some people, a subgroup working on that particular issue, and I think that would actually probably be the right place to go to for you to follow up on getting further information and also watching for when they come out with a little, as Sherry was saying, it was a Q&A, question and answer sort of little short fact sheet. That might be useful for you when it comes out.
Okay, great.
One thing I wanted to add in, this is kind of a basic concept, but it bears repeating, and I think maybe goes along the lines of maybe what the questioner was getting at, is, you know, many times we have contamination that affects numerous properties. It could be widespread. It could be groundwater plume. Could be soil contamination that has affected part of a city or a couple cities. And we do have some of these large sites that we have to address. And in those types of cases, the governmental controls are particularly useful for the widespread contamination, say the ordinance and the permit regulations. But there are pros and cons to using the governmental regulations, and I'm going to go into that toward the end of this presentation to talk a little bit more about the usefulness and some of the concerns about using those governmental regulations.
Okay. Our next question comes in from Ohio, and they ask, or they state, operation and maintenance, or O&M at most sites, is typically for a 30-year period. How does the 30-year O&M period mesh with the IC tracking? For example, how will ICs be tracked at a Superfund site beyond the O&M period? Is there a contingent process in place for that?
Well, I guess I'll jump in here first. Under Superfund, for the NPL sites, we are required to review any site which has contamination, which we call the UUUE standard, contamination that does not allow for unlimited use or unrestricted exposure. We're required at least every 5 years to review that site remedy and determine its protectiveness. That's what we call the 5-year review evaluation. So we would be, and there's no 30-year cap on that, so we would be expecting ICs, which require long-term maintenance, to go along with our 5-year review requirements. So there would be no 30-year cap on that.
Nor is there a cap, a 30-year cap, on the amount of time that EPA would need to continue to operate and maintain a remedy.
That's true.
Or monitor a site where there was waste left in place. It can be a misnomer or a misconception that activities are capped after 30 years. 30 years is merely a standard guideline for how long you would do a present worth cost estimate when comparing alternatives. Once you choose that alternative, though, if the alternative is that you're leaving waste in place, then you, as whoever is managing the site, must manage that waste in perpetuity. Now, when it comes to cost estimating, a present worth cost estimate where you just compare, like, a 30-year time horizon, is not the same as what it may actually cost an entity to implement the remedy that's actually selected. During a remedial design process, a design team can come up with more refined cost estimates, and especially when you're looking at how to fund it. And things have been done before where some kind of a trust fund was set up to fund maintenance in perpetuity, where they, you know, invest those funds and, you know, it generates, continually generates money that, that the entity uses to continue to operate the containment system typically. So, so Superfund does not stop after 30 years. Management and maintenance of a Superfund site does not actually stop after 30 years.
Okay. Our next question comes in from Michigan, and they ask, what is the difference between a title commitment report versus a title search? Are they the same or are they not? We found that title searches seem to focus only on financial issues such as liens.
Okay, I'll jump in first, Dante, and then you can add in. A title commitment is a type of title search. So title searches can be done in different manners, and we need to kind of understand what different title searches can do for us and what they, you know, what kind of information we're looking for. And then we order a title search based on what we're looking for. And a title commitment is a snapshot in time of the day or whatever, that period of time that you're looking for currently, what encumbrances exist, what liens, and what currently exists in terms of what the property title looks like. And that is distinctly different from a title search that's historic, which provides information about every property owner that's ever owned or had contact with that property, or every lien. And that, so there are different reasons that we ask for title work. And for what we're doing for ICs, we're looking for the title commitment, which is what exactly is done when you purchase a home. And they look, they do the title commitment, and they look to see what liens are on that property and what encumbrances exist then to see what you have to deal with and work with.
And my the Region 9 Legal Institutional Control Coordinator is here with me, and she can add a little bit to that. This is Sarah Mueller.
Yeah, I'll just add a little to what Sherry said. It basically is exactly what you would get from a title company when you are buying a piece of property. It tells you what the title company is agreeing to insure. And if you've ever looked at it, if you've bought a home, it's going to have a Schedule B, and it'll list all of the things that that are basically excluded from coverage, and that will be usually recorded things like liens or easements. And so as Sherry said, it's a snapshot in time showing you what exists on the property right then. It's not going to show you every owner or tenant back in the history of time. That would be a different product that you would have to order from a title company.
Thank you, Derek.
Thank you, Sarah.
For those of you who are asking what slide number we're on, we're answering questions, and we last left off on slide number 15. I'm going to take another question online, and this is a specific one, but they've asked that they not be named, so I'm going to ask this one out loud for them. And they ask, for the purposes of governmental controls, do Native villages entitled to land under Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or the ANSCA, quote, qualify for an MOU? And I can read that again if you want me to.
That's a very specific question.
Yeah, that I think that's too specific for me to be able to know. I would defer that to somebody like Cecilia in our headquarters office.
Okay.
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay.
And at this time, we probably need to move along to our discussion on guidances. And time permitting, we can take more questions later as well.
So we're on slide 16 now. And Dante and I thought we would briefly go over some of the hot off the press guidance, IC guidance that has come out, and some other resources that exist to help us get our ICs in place at our sites. So there's three specific guidance we're going to talk about, the PIME, the ICAP, and the 5-year view guidance. So, and then there's a link there, and I just want to point out the link has, if you go on there or you just Google search EPA and ICs and guidance, this is the link you'll get. And this is where the IC guidance is housed online. The PDF documents are there. And also we have, Dante and I have given some of the PDF documents to be included on the Cluin resource list. And those were posted too?
They were.
Okay, so that's another place to go. So why don't we turn to the next slide, slide 17. And Dante's going to talk a little bit about the PIME, which is the Guide to Planning, Implementing, Maintaining, and Enforcing Institutional Controls at Contaminated Sites.
That's right. So go ahead and proceed to 17, Planning, Implementing, Monitoring, and Enforcing. Now, the first guidance that we ever had on institutional controls was the Project Manager's Guide to Institutional Controls. It talked about what are institutional controls, the different types and that kind of thing. But the next thing that we really needed was a guidance that told about, well, how do you plan and implement a guidance, an institutional control? How do you actually do these things? And so this guidance has been under development for quite some time and is now in its interim final. It was published as an interim final version.
It's a robust 39.
Proceed to the next slide for the reference and the full title and call numbers for it. And on to number 19, where I'm going to just briefly highlight some of the concepts that were presented in this latest version of what we call the PIME guidance. This guidance is kind of a combination of real estate law and land use planning sort of things. It recognizes that doing institutional controls is very different than designing a pump and treat groundwater cleanup system or a soil gas extraction system and stuff. The whole thing about going through institutional controls and implementing them is that you're going through these other administrative processes or legal processes and whatnot. You're not doing typical engineering. And so the PIME guidance is kind of like a user's manual to what sorts of processes might you be facing and who should be doing what. Who, such as the local government, the state government, EPA, the PRPs, the PRPs, what is everybody going to be doing here? And that's very helpful because what used to happen is that somebody would select an institutional control in their Superfund record of decision, and it never got, you know, addressed during the design of the rest of the remedy, and it was just kind of something that everybody forgot about, and because nobody knew who was supposed to do what, much less how one would go about doing it. And so now this guidance is going to be talking a little bit more about that, and about how you should, you know, give general advice about how to engage stakeholders and local communities and the local governments, et cetera, when you're planning and implementing and evaluating and that kind of thing, which is really a very important thing to do because you need to look at institutional controls while you're doing your feasibility studies before you make the decision and start hiring people to start building things. You needed to have thought about it and gone through discussions with the local entities, whoever it may be. You needed to have done that well ahead of time. So this is definitely emphasized in the PIME guidance. Hit the next slide. The PIME guidance settles in on some couple of key policy issues here that in the past had been, you know, differences of opinion and whatnot, but this guidance was kind of, forming the guidance was a good way to pull everybody together to really address those questions and come down with some kind of definitive statement. One of those has to do with the whole, what we call UUUE, unrestricted use, unrestricted exposure, issue. And the way it settled out was that UUUE, whether there's waste left in place above unrestricted use level, is one factor, can be one factor in figuring out whether you would need an IC, an institutional control. There's a lot of discussions went behind that. There was people who thought that it should be the only factor, et cetera, et cetera. So the way it settles out is that's one factor to be considered. Another key thing, which is kind of logical, but it really needed to be said, was that the actual use restrictions that you're trying to implement in your institutional control need to be defined in your decision document, like your record of decision. A lot of times in the past, you know, 20 years of Superfund, it wasn't. It was an institutional control was kind of added in kind of as an afterthought, it felt like, and there wasn't any good definition in the ROD, the record of decision, about what it's supposed to do and what it's supposed to actually restrict. And so we are being very specific now and saying it and discussing it in the guidance about how you need to make that definition right there in the decision document and define it so that people who are implementing it have something to base their implementation on.
And also, it gives notice to the parties that was EPA's intent of restricting either resource or the property. So it's really important that our decision documents have enough information so that someone can figure that out. So what we're having to do on some of these older sites where we didn't select the IC as we would in today's decision documents is we're having to go back and revise our decision documents to either clarify, like a memo to the file or an ESD, explanation of significant differences to kind of tease out some of those ICs, or in some cases where the IC was never even discussed, doing a full-blown ROD amendment to revise our remedy decision.
Now, in the case of federal facilities, EPA got very, very detailed, oriented, and involved in defining institutional controls in the record of decision, because the record of decision is the only, it is the key document that we have that we can use to force the Department of Defense to do things or the other federal agency to do the things that we want. And so actually EPA got very detailed in federal facility rods in terms of defining the institutional controls and whatnot. We came up with big checklists from headquarters and stuff.
Tom, can you confirm what slide number you're on?
21.
Thank you.
21. Community involvement and interaction with local governments is definitely one of the significant policy issues that this guidance raises, and I was just talking about that, about how the importance of that has really evolved and risen to the forefront now. And so, like I was saying earlier, the community involvement and the outreach and evaluation that you would do with the local entities, evaluating their abilities, what sort of programs they have in place, what sort of departments or whatnot they have in place, that really goes a long way in figuring out whether and what type of institutional control might work in that situation.
And there are some other, it's a really wonderful guidance. There's some other aspects to it, definitions that get thrown around a lot, so that's a good place to look up some of those definitions and terminology. There's also reference to some other resources. And one of the things I also wanted to mention is that it also highlights the enforcement first principles in Superfund that apply to ICs as well, and that's that the responsible parties will perform the cleanup or pay for it. So the responsible parties are the folks that we go to first to make sure that they're going to help implement these ICs and to monitor them in the long term.
Now, we only have time now to just give you a couple of quick highlights with regards to this guidance. Probably if we wanted to do a whole training on it, it would take, two or 3 hours or 4 hours in and of itself. And so we only have time to give a couple highlights, and we'll do the same with the next couple of guidances that we would like to talk about. So Sherry is going to take us to the next slide, and we will talk about institutional controls in five-year reviews.
Okay, so we're on slide 22, which introduces the topic. So then move on to slide 23. And this is actually the guidance that was issued in September 2011, recommended evaluation of institutional controls, and it's called the supplement to the comprehensive five-year review guidance from 2001, I believe it was issued. So the 2001 guidance was very thorough, but it didn't go into enough detail on how to evaluate ICs during the five-year review. So before this guidance was issued, there was a draft supplement, which we were all using, the concept, and that was a collaborative guidance that came from a lot of experience and work group participation. And then finally, it came to a final guidance in September 2011. So this is the final guidance, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that. Slide 24 talks about what I just said, that this guidance supplements the 2001 comprehensive five-year review guidance. They work hand in hand, and it provides the recommendations for conducting the five-year reviews as a remedy component, just like any other type of remedy component, engineered remedy component. So we're definitely going through evaluating our five-year review specifically for ICs, just as any other component. Okay, go to slide 25. Just a little definition here of making sure we're all on the same page, understanding what the purpose of the five-year review evaluation is. There are several purposes. One is to review and evaluate the implementation and performance of the remedy to ensure that it's still protective or will be protective once the remedial action is implemented. And so it has to be protective of human health and the environment, and then we make a determination both in the short term whether it's protective and the long term. And that is what's the purposes, both in the comprehensive five-year review evaluation guidance, and then which is sort of bolstered in the IC supplement of how you would do that when you're looking at an IC. How does that protectiveness statement sort of evolve, and how should they look? Because we want to be consistent across the country when we're making these determinations. So this guidance has helped out a lot to help with that consistency and give us the tools we need to make that statement.
This guidance is particularly helpful in the situations where EPA has its contractors or maybe the state doing a five-year review for us, and people outside of EPA may not be so familiar with institutional controls, you know, what they are, the definitions, how it works and stuff, and therefore they would be kind of lost on how to evaluate that in the context of a five-year review.
And then another a big part of the five-year review process is just looking, not only determining if our remedy is protective, but also
picking out some issues that maybe are developing or that we found during our evaluation, and determining follow-up actions, because we want to make sure that we're understanding our remedy is performing as it's intended, and that that remedy is still protective. So those are some parts of the five-year review evaluation, and again, the IC evaluation is conducted within the context of that evaluation, just like any other remedy component. So the reports that are issued, which document the evaluation, are mostly authored by the federal, by US EPA. EPA is writing those protective determinations. It's our authority to do that. And I'm going to go through a little bit more about how the PRPs can help with that, how the community can help with that, but that is our authority, except for federal facility sites, whereas the other federal agency does make the federal, the protectiveness determination, and then US EPA would either concur or non-concur on that, and then can say why that happens. But in most cases, in these private sites, it is going to be US EPA making that determination. So that's the essence of this five-year review, the purpose. And so I'm going to move you to slide 26. And these are some key questions that we ask when we're looking at ICs at, in the five-year review. So one thing we want to make sure is that we know what the use restrictions are intended to be. What are we supposed to have in place? What does our decision document sort of say the remedial action objectives are, and how does that translate to an IC to restrict use of water, restrict use of soils, or whatever it can be. And that also works hand-in-hand with the exposure assessments and pathways. If we know the probable pathways, then we can design our ICs to be very meaningful. So we want to kind of take a look at those exposure pathways and the assumptions from the previous, from the RODs and the previous five-year reviews to make sure they're still accurate. Do we have new exposures occurring? And if we do, why is that? Is it because we have contamination that has moved, like a plume that's moving, where we now we have new properties affected? Or is it that there was a part that we never really fully delineated, and so now it's sort of we're just finding out that we have contamination in a place we didn't expect? So looking at those exposure pathways and making sure it still makes sense, and then that'll be captured in the five-year review. Another important aspect is just understanding what our site is, what our property is that's effective, and trying to clarify that in terms of property descriptions, legal descriptions of property, maps, GIS information. So all of that's just hugely important in understanding where the contamination is or has come to be located, and then kind of matching that up with the ICs that are in place or that need to be implemented. So we're doing that mapping component. And then another huge component is, even after we have determined our ICs are in place and effective, are we monitoring it? What kind of what role are the PRPs doing the long-term stewardship? Is that EPA that's doing it? And is it a joint effort? We might have a local government who needs to help us understand how they've been implementing their ordinance. So there's just a lot of components that go into that long-term stewardship, and that's one thing that we look at during the five-year review, if there's a procedure in place for that. Dante, you want to add anything on that key question?
No, I like your descriptions. We'll leave it at that.
So going to the next slide then, which is 27, this slide indicates some of the procedures that we go through in the five-year review evaluation. And actually, this is the same whether you're looking at a IC as a remedy component or any other remedy component. We're looking at documents that exist
in our review, we're interviewing whoever we need to interview, and we're inspecting the site, and we're coming up, combining all this information to come up with a protectiveness statement and to make an evaluation.
Now, the key documents that you would be revealing would be the documents that implemented the institution control, be it the a proprietary control, deed restriction sort of thing. Well, let's see. Get your hands on it. Make sure that it was done. If it was outreach informational flyers or letters or anything like that, get copies of all those and review them to see what they say. If it was an ordinance that was passed by the city or something, get a copy of it. Include that in the five-year review and read through it and see if it has all the necessary restrictions.
So what we do if we're within 1 year of the five-year review, usually, is if it's a PRP lead site, we'll send out a letter asking the responsible parties to help us with that evaluation, to give us copies of those covenants that are in place or ordinances, to do an evaluation of it, to get their view on the reliability of those instruments, and to make some recommendations on how to best make these ICs to be protective in the long term. And then we'll look at that. It might be title work, looking at the title work, looking at the encumbrances, and seeing how to best bolster the ICs, and it may be additional ICs that might be required. So that's all part of this IC evaluation that we go through. And then there will be a protectiveness statement, both short-term and long-term. Now, in the guidance that we're talking about, there are some very useful examples of protectiveness statements for some more or less typical scenarios, like a landfill or some groundwater treatment remedies, and then basically goes through an analysis of how we would look at whether it's protective in the short term and protective in the long term. So we're looking at whether the IC is in place, we're looking at possible exposure scenarios, and whether there's any breaches that we know or are likely. And all that gets wrapped up into sort of an analysis of protectiveness. And then the last bullet there, role of PRPs. As I mentioned, it's US EPA's authority to make the protectiveness determination and sort of complete the review of the five-year review and author the report, but we like to get assistance. We encourage it. We ask the PRPs to help us with evaluations, to do some of the work, and it's actually in our model consent decree that the PRPs would assist us with the five-year review evaluation. So if you want to turn to the next slide, slide 28.
Yeah, these next three slides kind of run through the three questions that we ask ourselves in order for us to make our protectiveness determination. We ask ourselves the following three questions. Question A, is the remedy functioning as intended by the decision document? And what does that mean in terms of ICs, Sherry?
So it's really just looking at what the remedy decision document decided the role of the IC was in making sure that the remedy is protective, and then understanding if it's happening. So if the IC was required, is it clear what part of the site it was to be applied to? Is it clear what the objectives were that was supposed to be restricted, or what kind of land use was appropriate, the physical layout of the ICs, do they cover all of the area that the use restriction is supposed to cover, is specified by the rod. So, for example, if you have a groundwater ordinance that restricts installation of groundwater wells, but the ordinance only applies in a county, one county, and you have groundwater contamination that's crossed into another county, then you do not have an effective IC that covers the use restriction specified in the rod. So we have to do a lot of that sort of analysis. Another point is, are there any exposures occurring? We really want to make sure that we're not having a problem with that. So we have to ask those right questions and make a statement whether any exposures are occurring. Let's go to question B, slide 29.
Question B is, are the exposure assumptions, toxicity data, cleanup levels, and remedial action objectives still valid? Now, this might have some issues with regards to land use or if there's a new toxicity value that came out for a contaminant, then your cleanup levels might not be insufficient, and those sort of issues might come into play. Common one that we've been experiencing at sites all across the country is exposure pathways, where we hadn't maybe evaluated the vapor intrusion pathway until more recently, and so some of these older sites where there's, you know, some institutional controls in place maybe, they find that because of vapor intrusion, our remedy, our institutional control may be inadequate. And so those sorts of situations might come up. Changes in land use, though, are usually the most obvious ones, and they can, however, hit us blindsided because we're not necessarily keeping track of what's going on.
So that's really important to make sure as we're doing our five-year review and evaluation, we understand if there's been any change in land use. And if that's occurred where there's been either an IC that was supposed to have been in place or an area that IC was supposed to get implemented, we could have a problem, and we have to make sure we're addressing that and figuring out if we need to do more in terms of the remedy. So let's turn to the next slide. Slide 30, and this is question C. Has any other information come to light that could call into question the remedy protectiveness?
And this is a kind of the broad, all-encompassing category of anything else that we haven't already mentioned. But things like, you know, a state law could have changed, or the contamination could have migrated out of the areas where it previously was into new areas. And this is particularly the area, the question also to look for any breaches, any known breaches. Have people been digging where they weren't supposed to, or starting to use the groundwater where they weren't supposed to? All that sort of information would feed into the determination of whether your IC was working or not. So what if it wasn't working?
So let's go to the next.
Look at the next slide. The five-year review. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. These are some typical recommendations that we're going to see based on our evaluation of the IC effectiveness during the review. We may decide we need to select and implement an IC because of either new contamination or the ones that are in place haven't really achieved the purpose. And one thing I wanted to point out is if we decide to select an additional IC, we may have to go back to that decision document and make it in terms of a decision that's made by the agency. So the evaluation recommendation in the five-year review does not take the place of a remedy decision document. It only makes a recommendation to follow up.
Nor does it make a determination that something has necessarily failed. If the IC is having some reliability issues, like there have been a few breaches or something, then maybe you just need to do better outreach, or maybe you need to have some kind of stronger monitoring in place or something like that. And so one recommendation could be that you sit down and do a reliability evaluation of your IC and, think about it some more and see if you can come up with ideas for how to improve it or whether it really is a lost cause. But you don't throw it out right away just because there was, you know, a breach sometime in the that was recognized by the 5-year review. You might need a better communication strategy to inform the people who have the potential for being exposed, do better outreach to, be it the business community or construction contractors who might be digging where they aren't supposed to, or the water purveyors, et cetera, et cetera.
And we have examples of sort of informal communication plans that we found have been useful to sit down and understand all the different players that are involved in making sure our ICs are effective. And then examples of some more formal ones in terms of MOUs that have been signed to make sure that the communication occurs. And we'd be happy to share those with you. One thing I want to point out is the second bullet there, need an additional IC layer. This might be something that's a recommendation that additional IC might be prudent to make sure that we are not going to have any breach or any issue. And as Dante went through some of the slides earlier in this webinar with the ICs in Indian Country, you saw the analysis of the pros and cons of each type of IC. So the each type of IC does have a thing that might be more conducive to helping with the IC, or might be have some kind of a problem, maybe getting in place, or a problem with enforcing. Just little issues that we like to analyze all of that. So we like to, the concept of layering, meaning using more than one IC to achieve the purpose, to try to make sure that we're not missing something. So that might be one of your recommendations in your 5-year review, is to get additional ICs in place.
Now, one of my favorite is the long-term stewardship plan. When an IC is in place, sometimes it's going to be in place for perpetuity. And people in the past have given short shrift to the thinking forward of how to monitor it and be the steward for the institutional control. And so sometimes even if it's, you know, later on and you had some breaches or something, sitting down and coming up with a good long-term plan. And that can be an evolving plan, of course, as you get more experience and whatnot. But the bottom line is that it might take more effort than people thought at first.
And that's one thing we're looking for in the 5-year review, is that there's a long-term stewardship plan. It might be not called that. It might be part of the O&M plan. It might be part of the ICIAP that we're going to talk about. But there needs to be some statement of whose responsibility it is going to be to ensure that the ICs remain in place and that they remain effective. And then the last bullet there is another possible recommendation, is exploring the use of the state's one call system for ICs. Every state has a one call system which is used for utilities. So if someone's going to dig or put a project in place, they call the one call hotline, they come out and they mark it, and then people know, contractors know not to go ahead and dig where they've been marked because they're utilities or something else. Well, we have this concept of using the one call systems that are already in place to put our IC information, our residual contamination information in place. And we've got a couple examples of these that have been used throughout the country. And we'd like to just make people aware that that's something that you might want to consider as an IC layer.
In addition to contaminated soil, of course, one could use the one call system, and probably should use it if you have a pump and treat system where you've got pipelines connecting your wells to your treatment units and all that kind of stuff, because you don't want somebody digging in and hitting your pipeline. And so all the other pipeline owners and utility owners, they're all signed up with the one call system, and they get alerts when somebody wants to dig in the area and they go out and mark it. We should too, especially if we have pipelines or slurry walls or any other kind of physical infrastructure that's underground.
Yes, and we have had a few of our remedies get kind of unearthed, so to speak, because of not knowing that what was under there. So good point, Dante. So if you want to turn to the next slide, slide 32, it's basically a summary of that the one of the purposes of the five-year review is to make that protectiveness determination, and ICs are considered along with other remedy components, and I've already mentioned that the protectiveness determination examples are listed in the five-year review guidance. But if you have any questions going through that process, any of the IC coordinators or your five-year review coordinators or headquarters would be happy to answer those to make sure that we're all looking at this kind of the same way.
So this guidance supplement is also included in the materials posted for the webinar. So it's everybody gets all of the good stuff all at once. Let's move along to slide 33. Your ICIAP, the Institutional Controls Implementation and Assurance Plan. This plan is something that's having a guidance for it being developed. What we have so far and what we included in the materials for the webinar is an outline of it. What is it? Go to slide 34. The ICIAP is essentially your design document for your institutional controls. You would put together a plan after you signed your remedy decision document, your ROD or whatever, and while you're designing, you know, your tap or your pump and treat system and doing the drawings and stuff, well, you can also get some folks together and put together your design for your institutional controls. That would include who is going to do what needs to happen for your various controls to be put in place, how are you going to maintain it, and what would you do if there was a breach or somebody's violating it, what kind of enforcement steps would you do? And finally, at the end of your project, if it's all cleaned up, can you terminate them, and what are the steps for doing that, if applicable? If your site may need ICs in place in perpetuity, in which case you wouldn't have provisions for closing them out. But the key thing is that this is the design and a maintenance and monitoring plan for your ICs all in the same place. It forces your project team to sit down and think it all through, figure out who's going to do what, be it the state takes a role or is it the PRPs who are going to take a role, and how are they going to do it exactly, what's their interaction with EPA, et cetera, et cetera. So it lays it all out. On the next slide, 35, it notes that this plan is already defined in the model consent decree that we had discussed earlier. So it's, even though it doesn't have a published guidance yet, it does, in the consent decree, it does say this plan has to be done, and here's the things that it needs to include, roughly. And so this guideline, this outline that we attach to the materials here, is a perfect thing to use to just, you know, work your own way through it. I would say it probably wouldn't require a huge guidance to explain what you should put in each part. It's pretty self-explanatory. And my description here is enough to give you the idea of what it is you're supposed to do, and the guideline gives you an outline for how to go ahead and put a plan like that together.
And I just want to mention that the ICIAP is also mentioned in the PINE. So it's definitely envisioned that we're going to be putting this guidance out to help folks understand more what we're looking for in terms of that plan, but the outline is very useful. So, I, like you said, I don't think the guidance really have to be that robust to go ahead and explain more.
Now, on the next slide after that, I just talked about this slide 36.
Okay, great.
Slide 37 gives you references for the other guidances that we had actually mentioned before. One of them, at least, the Site Manager's Guide, as well as the Citizen's Guide to Institutional Controls, and the Bibliography. The Bibliography is actually a really great resource. It was put together back in the mid-2000s by somebody from headquarters named Marissa. So we kind of always refer to it as Marissa's Bibliography. She went through all the different EPA guidances and stuff, and even the regs and laws, and cited wherever institutional controls came up. So it was a great way for us to get our arms around everything that had been done so far, and then you can always use it to look up what else there was up until 2005. So anything you want to add, Sherry, before we move to our last segment?
No, I think we should move on or take questions.
Okay, we can take a few questions about the guidance, but we do want to talk about some of these case studies. They're really interesting, too. So, Jean, we can take a few questions if people have questions about the guidance.
Okay. This first question is coming in from Boston, and it's about the ICIAP, which they state is a new acronym to them. They say LUCIP/LUCAP, they know, at least for federal facilities. So they ask if you could address the, I don't know if it would be pronounced LUCIP or LUCAP.
Yeah, the LUCIP, Land Use Control Implementation Plan, I believe it stands for, is the type of plan that's often used at those federal facilities. And the ICIAP, ICAP or ICIAP, however you pronounce it, would kind of be equivalent, but it's not thought it's going to be as detailed as what's in a LUCIP, because the LUCIP in the federal facility side of the house, you know, they're really, oftentimes they're very large sites with multiple areas of contamination and multiple types of ICs that need to be implemented. So just by the fact that the type of site it's addressed, those LUCIPs are often very huge. There are a lot of maps involved, a lot of delineation. An ICIAP is going to be more along the lines of maybe an O&M plan, I guess, for monitoring and maintaining. It might have an implementation schedules in there if ICs haven't been implemented. You know, it can be flexible. It's there to help us kind of distinguish that we have these ICs, they're a component of the remedy, and they may need their own plan to get implemented and monitored.
Okay. The next question, it's part of the same question, so I'm not sure how much of this is a question or a statement, but they said that typically the LUC/RD is done after a ROD. RODs have the objectives but not details, and the LUCRD or IP or CAP have the details of what is actually prohibited or allowed.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. They ask, another question is coming in from Wisconsin, and they ask if you can direct them to a source for the ICIAP outline suggested as a guide for developing that document.
The only source would be what's posted for this webinar, because the guidance itself is under development, nothing's been published yet, but the outline was something that they put forth just internally, and it's something that's very useful for people to go ahead and use. So you can get it from this, from the resources for this webinar that get posted, and that's That's about it.
Okay, great.
Otherwise, you'd have to ask your local institutional control coordinator to send you a copy of it.
Okay. And, again, we'll cover how you can access the additional resources page before we close things out today. The next question comes in from Portland, and I'm not sure how much this is related to your topic, but they ask, will headquarters update the 2005 bibliography?
We'll have to ask James about that. I can make a note of that.
Good idea. Thank you for bringing it up.
Excellent idea.
I think you can recommend that.
Okay, great. I have a very detailed question about a site, which I don't know if you'd like me to hold. I have many other ones in the queue, so I don't know if you want to keep going or if you'd like to carry on.
Yeah, let's carry on, and then we should have time left at the end for some of these other questions.
Okay, great.
So let's move to slide 38, and this is sort of our last topic that we put forth for this webinar. And we wanted to talk a little bit more about EPA collaboration with local and state government. And these are the governmental controls that we talk about how we, as an agency, the U.S. EPA, do have a lot of authority, but we also don't have some of the important authority that the local and state governments have, and that's in terms of, like, issuing ordinances or the state regulations for permitting. We really don't have that authority at the federal government. And we need to, a lot of times, those local government authorities are just what we need to make our remedy protective. And so we like to work with the state and local governments to make sure that what they have either on their books already is effective or even help them draft and pass a regulation or ordinance that will help us be an IC for our sites. And this is really important because these governmental controls, it gives us another level of government that can help make sure that it's happening. And also, these governmental controls can, as I mentioned earlier, be applied to large tracts of land, like countywide, statewide, whereas the proprietary control, which is what we really like, that proprietary control because it attaches to the property, but it's only one property at a time. So it takes a lot of resources to get those in place, and we think there's an important role for them, but there's these governmental controls can really serve a nice purpose for the ICs to be effective. Now, local and state governments have authorities based on their police powers, where they can protect health and welfare and safety. So this is a nice authority they have, and we like to work with them to try to get our ICs in place. So, and a lot of times what we've done in the past is we haven't really worked collaboratively with our local governments. We've maybe talked to them, or maybe it's after the fact. We looked at their ordinance and said, oh, this is really nice. Maybe they can amend it to make it be a little bit more effective, or we ask them, you know, how they're enforcing it. So what we really want to promote is the fact that we can be working together collaboratively, and there are ways to kind of help that work out. So the next slide is slide 39, and here are some examples of EPA-IC collaboration at some Superfund sites.
Yeah, so I've heard a presentation by the South Florida Water Management District at one of our NARPM conferences, and I thought that was a really good case study to mention here. So in Florida, or at least in this district in Florida, this water management district is a local governmental agency that has, like, complete authority and power over regulating the use of the groundwater. And so they partnered with EPA to set up a system where EPA would give them the information about a particular Superfund site contaminated groundwater plume, and they'd map it into their GIS system and stuff, and they'd add it to their areas of purview, and they passed their own rules or regulations that that laid out restrictions on contaminated groundwater use and, you know, well installation and permitting and whatnot. If anybody wanted to install a well, they needed to get a permit from the water agency, and the water agency then would know if it was contaminated, and they would then go through a procedure of testing it and whatnot, and comparing it to the location of the plume, and so they essentially, this was a good example of a local entity that had police power and partnered with EPA to pass regulations that that put procedures in place that then the local entity would implement in policing any use of the groundwater.
And to make that procedure, to kind of firm up that procedure of whose role was what and how to work together, there was this formal memorandum of agreement that was put out, was signed by both entities. And so that was a nice way of sitting down and not only, saying there's a procedure in place, but writing it down so each party knows what their exact role was and, how to keep making sure that the IC is in place and someone's watching over that. So that's good. And we have an example of that if anyone would like to see it.
Another example that I remember hearing a presentation about at one of the conferences was Bunker Hill up in Idaho. It was called the Panhandle Health District. It was a health district that encompassed four kind of smallish communities, and the contamination was from a Superfund site that was a lead smelting operation or something like that. And the contamination was very, very extensive, and it was basically in the soil in huge, huge areas. And so the health district had the authorities to be able to put in place regulations within those areas. And part of the agreement with EPA was that, and the PRPs, was that the PRPs would provide funding for the health district to operate the institutional control that was then put in place. The restrictions that were put in place were all these rules for how to handle soil. So anytime anybody dug in the soil, and it may have been like below 6 inches or whatever, but anytime anybody dug in the soil, there was these procedures that they had to follow, essentially, hazardous materials type handling procedures that then the inspector from the health district, they had a full-time person whose job it was to go around and help educate people and keep an eye on things. And when people were digging, without a permit, educated them, made them, get a permit and stuff. And so they actually had somebody funded to go around and police that. And it wasn't that they were trying to stop people from digging because, that life goes on. People need to dig every now and then and, be it on their own property or in putting in a new utility or something. And so informational outreach and education was part of it, but he also had his police powers. And that was through a local health district, which was really interesting.
I'll talk a little bit about this, the City of Aspen Ordinance at the Smuggler Mountain site in Region 8. There's a real nice website which shows kind of how this evolved. But the Smuggler Superfund site was covered in mining waste. I guess it was throughout the town the mining waste was identified. And they did some cleanup, but as part of the remedy, ICs were to be implemented for some of the residual contamination, which was not only in commercial properties, but also on residential properties. So this institutional control that was adopted required anyone engaged in activities that were going to either excavate or even expose soil which had contamination would have to follow certain work practice procedures, and they may have to get a permit depending on how much soil they're moving. If it's more than one cubic yard of soil, then they would have to get this permit. And even if they didn't have to get the permit, the landowner or contractor who's moving the soil had to follow the work practice standards, including dust suppression, and if they were going to take some of the soil and move it off the land, they had to identify where it was going. And it also talked about landscaping as well as vegetable and flower gardening had to follow certain requirements. So this was a way to not remove all the contamination that was found in the town, but to try to have some control and management of this residual contamination through a pretty robust IC program. And that's something that, again, there's a nice nice website that shows how that developed and shows the ordinance and the permits and all of that. That's one thing. And then the last one I think I'll mention is the Region 7, City of Excelsior Springs, Missouri. The Health Department, or Department of Natural Resources, had a role in ensuring that the groundwater wasn't used inappropriately, and they had a permit they have a permit program in place. And there's also the local city has an ordinance that sort of goes further, the way I understand it, and everyone was saying that that would be used as the IC for the site. The concern, however, was that the city may revoke that somehow without knowledge, you know, whether on purpose or not on purpose. It could happen that the governmental body not know that it's the importance of that ordinance. So there was an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, that was entered between the city and the municipality, which basically had some terms that said, you know, if you're ever going to think of changing the ordinance, that you notify the department, you notify the EPA, and then also had some siting requirements for potable water supply wells in the area. So, again, this MOU takes that concept of local government and the importance of using governmental controls, but adds a few bells and whistles on it to make sure that it's effective in the long term. So these are some pretty creative options that we've considered to try to make sure our ICs are more protective. So I think that's all I was going to talk about. Anything else there from you, Dante?
That was all I was going to mention. So why don't we open up now to questions about anything IQ related.
We have many, many questions in the queue, but before I switch to those that were typed up electronically, I want to start and see if anybody on the phone lines has a question. Again, if you're on the phone and you'd like to ask the question directly, hit #6 to unmute your line or use your own mute button to unmute, and feel free to identify yourself or organization to ask your question.
We have one here in Region 9.
My name is Craig Cooper. I'm an RPM. I've got a couple questions, and you can take them in any order. A lot of our sites have multiple operable units, and therefore with ICs, and then multiple rods, and then therefore multiple RDs. Does the guidance speak to how to tie ICs from various operable units and various RDs in together? I'm assuming there's a preference toward a comprehensive IC management plan site-wide, and not because the presentation talked about how it's broken up RD by RD, and there could be some confusion about, you know, having to write a separate IC plan for each operable unit or each RD. It seems like it would make more sense to have one that's site-wide. I don't know if anybody has any experience with that.
Well, the IC plan guidance is being developed right now, and so it has never even come out in a draft, so I don't know what it would or wouldn't say. However, I would think that there's enough flexibility for a site manager to wrap all their IC plans together, from different OUs and whatnot. I think that's a logical approach.
Yeah. To me, it seems like it would get really confusing if you have a different IC plan for different RDs floating around. It'd be hard to, you know, just for tracking.
Sure.
It would be hard. Also, one last question. Do you have somebody have something to say on that?
Well, I said I agree with you. I think the practical approach is to have one plan that you might keep maybe amending if new information comes up.
Right.
Right.
Has anybody heard of an institutional control barring ecological reuse at a particular portion of the site? As you know, when we do risk assessments, we have an ecological risk assessment which drives ecological-based cleanup levels, and that could just apply for a certain portion of the site, and then the other portion could be residential or recreational or whatever. Have you ever heard of an IC, at least, you know, again, you know, protecting against an ecological reuse of a particular portion of the site, only because ecological-based cleanup levels were never applied there, and the parties, maybe EPA or somebody, didn't want that to be forgotten, and for the future property owner to expand a wetlands or to expand, you know, something that into an area that never was meant for ecological reuse.
I've never heard of one like that. Sherry, have you?
I'm trying to think if I've heard of one, and I haven't, but I can think of a few scenarios where it might happen. So I would say if you want, we can consult with you, and if you have a particular site or issue, we can do on that.
Okay, in the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and move along to some of the ones that have been typed up electronically. And I'm going to start in the order that I received them, so they're going to start earlier in your presentation. And this first question is coming in from Washington, D.C., and they state, based on the disadvantages listed in the previous slides, is it rare for EPA to use ICs as part of a Superfund remedy, since it seems rather difficult to ensure that the ICs will be properly implemented and or enforced? What do RPMs do to counter these disadvantages?
Well, in Superfund in general, ICs are very common. Those slides that they were referring to are probably specific to Indian lands. Those slides were talking about ICs on Indian lands, pros and cons. And ICs on Indian lands is fairly new. And we do not yet have a big body of experience. And so I would say that, to my knowledge, ICs on Indian lands are not yet common.
And related to that question, someone mentioned exactly that it sounds to them from their list, they're listening to today, that basically the work group would not recommend using ICs in Indian country. And they want to know if that's a correct assessment.
That is not a correct assessment. The analysis that we go through is to understand the weaknesses of the ICs, but when we're leaving contamination and there's a legacy we have to address, ICs serve a very important function, and we are still having to work through some of those issues on the Indian lands, but I would say we still think it's a very important part of the remedy.
And the disadvantages that were mentioned is just a laundry list of disadvantages that could apply in a situation, or they might not.
And that's why we like the concept of layering, to try to give that a little extra bolstering of the effectiveness of our ICs.
Okay. Our next question comes in from Oregon, and they ask, during remedial design, what are important considerations related to development of an institutional control plan, and how much specific detail is appropriate? How would this ICP ultimately be related to the implementation of ICs during the remedial action?
That was kind of had a number of parts to it, but
yep.
The first part sounded like what are the key considerations
yep.
In doing your plan, And I would say the key considerations are figuring out what is the procedure that you need to go through for each of the different institutional controls that your ROD called for. For example, if it called for a deed restriction and also a governmental control, then how is the deed restriction implemented? And, you know, the answer probably is you have your attorney, you know, sit down and negotiate with the private property landowner, and, you know, there's a boilerplate deed restriction for Oregon, and, you know, that needs to be used, et cetera, et cetera. And then the filing procedure with the county is XYZ, you know, that kind of thing. And if it's a governmental control, then it's like, okay, we need to go through the procedure of passing an ordinance, and what does that entail? Will you go to the city council or the town council or whatever? So procedures, I think, are the key considerations. And what was the other parts of that question?
The rest of it was they were really getting into about the level of detail that you needed to include, and then they wanted to know how the plan is actually going to be related to the implementation of the IC during remedial action.
Again, the idea is this plan is to be flexible to meet the needs of the project, but to think about implementation is important, especially earlier than we have in the past. So just kind of thinking of key points and trying to put some deadlines down about, you know, who's going to do what and what and what's their timeline for implementation.
Yeah, I would include a level of detail where you say what the step is, and who's going to do it, but you don't necessarily need to do all the write-ups of the initial documents and stuff. You would consider that to be part of your remedial action. So I would say the relationship between that design document and the action is the design document gives you like a map, like a roadmap of the different steps that you'll take in the remedial action.
Okay. All right, our next question coming in, there's actually a couple people who are asking about the PIME guidance that's dated November 2010 and not November 2011. A number of people would like to know if the 2010 is either a typo or if there's a more recent guidance for that.
The 2011 is the replacement of the 2010. The 2010 was a earlier draft.
Okay. And are there links to the 2011 document? They're claiming that they can't find them online.
Did you post that, Jean?
If it was one of the files you guys gave us, then absolutely would have been included on the resources page.
And so the question is, where else online could it be? Because I'm pretty sure that I got it from EPA's national webpage.
It is on there. I looked yesterday. I know it's on there. So if the requester still can't find it and wants to find the link, they can contact me.
Okay. There are many, many questions still in the queue, so I want to check with you guys before we can go a few minutes beyond our scheduled end time to try to answer more questions, and then if we still can't get through everything, I can get the questions to our presenters so that they can address them offline either by email or by calling the speakers.
Sure.
You guys are okay to stay a few more minutes?
I am, and sure. I did want to say one thing. One of the slides I had a point that I wanted to make and I forgot, so just 1 minute on this one important thing. If someone is trying to get an IC implemented and they're having some problems with getting the landowner, especially like an innocent landowner or someone in the community to understand the importance of it, we can provide help that way to try to get them to communicate with the community members. EPA also has a facilitation contract, which means they have like a neutral person who can go out and kind of try to facilitate if situation's getting a little agitated, as they do sometimes when people don't want anyone to come on their property or to limit their property uses. And some of the things to think about is possibly putting out some fact sheets or communicating with the local real estate official, real estate developers or just to try to get more information into the community so they understand what we're trying to do, and we're not just trying to restrict a property right without having, you know, their reasons. How this
okay.
Kind of fits. I just want to give up.
And this is a reminder, if you're on the phone, please do line line. Star 6 to mute your line. Okay, great. Thanks so much. Okay, so I'm going to continue on with the electronic questions that have been submitted. And this next question is coming in from Illinois, and they're asking for specific differences between the PIME guidance that was issued in 2010 versus the most recent edition in 2011.
Off the top of my head, I do not know. Sherry, are you?
I don't know either.
Now, this is answering questions.
There's no more slides.
You don't know the answer?
I don't know the answer. I don't think there's any inconsistency.
Okay.
But if they want to contact me offline, I'd be happy to walk through it with them.
Okay.
And I think Chip Love in headquarters would be a good person to ask about that because he was involved with that guidance.
Okay. The next question comes in, and they're asking if you have examples of innovative IC.
I think the innovative ones were the ones like the South Florida and the Bunker Hill ones. I was always most impressed with those, the use of kind of creative ways of partnering with local entities.
Yeah, one thing we're looking at one of the sites I'm working on we mentioned it briefly, but using the One Call system where we have contamination in areas of the community that, like under roads and under just areas that we probably haven't fully identified just because of how pervasive the contamination was at one point, and we just have a sense that we haven't fully delineated. So we're using the One Call system to be the process to notify, and then we're coming up with like a sort of a fact sheet for the excavator who would get the One Call notice that basically says, hey, you should probably be aware you might encounter contamination. This is what it looks like. Here's who you can talk to about it. And just gives them a whole bunch of information that they wouldn't normally probably have. I mean, it's all available online, but it's just getting it to the right person at the right time.
And I would also mention a Region 9 example of an innovative institutional control whereby EPA, in order to do an informational institutional control regarding a fish advisory, EPA partnered with local health agencies and local ethnic groups in Los Angeles and Orange County, which is a huge population, and in order to target the specific people who were eating the most fish caught from the shoreline and from immediately offshore, they partnered with ethnic-based health organizations in order to get the message to those different ethnic populations across, you know, language lines and other, you know, cultural barriers to effective communication. We went into their communities using their existing community-based structures. And this was a huge collaborative and that was done in the earlier, starting in the earlier 2000s, and it's been in place for about 10 years now.
And then sort of to piggyback on that, there was a site here in Region 5 where, again, the fish advisory was going to be one of the ICs that were to be relied upon. And we're always concerned about fish advisories because we can't really enforce them. So it's really only getting information and hopefully, you know, people take that seriously. But what this, site team did is they went into a local grade school in the area and had them, educated them and had them do like an art contest and then they selected, I think, some of the designs from the art contest for the actual fish advisory notice. And I think they developed a calendar, too, of some of the artwork. So to get more information into the school kids to bring home was innovative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, nice. The next question is coming in from Boston, and they ask, would a local town ordinance, for example, that restricts the installation of private wells, be considered an acceptable IC?
Yes.
It could be. It depends, really, because it has to be enforced.
It's an example of a governmental control.
Yes.
And it's one that's done. It's somewhat common. I mean, it has been done a number of times.
So what we do when we look at these ordinances that already exist is we review them and we make sure it goes as far as we need it to in terms of the objectives that it's serving, the enforcement. We might bolster it with a communication strategy and just outreach so that the community, local government won't revoke it without our knowledge. So, you know, we can use it, but we have to make sure it's going to work for the long term.
Okay. Our next question comes in from Chicago, and they ask, how would one go about finding information on existing ICs? Are there existing databases within the agency, or would this be a local search?
Within EPA's webpage, if one looks at the at information on a particular Superfund site, there will be information about the institutional controls, but it's based on our institution control tracking system, and it doesn't, the database there doesn't necessarily have mapping type information or extent that it applies to, so it's somewhat limited.
Okay. I think I'm going to take two more questions online, and then we'll go ahead and move on with some closing statements just to wrap things up. If there were questions submitted that were not answered live, I will be sure to pass those on to the presenters so they can answer them offline. So, you know, one more question, and then we'll do two more for online. And the next one asks if there is a tribal IC case study available.
Hmm.
There are, I believe, at least a couple. And I would say to contact Cecilia, who was mentioned, you know, earlier in there. But I know there are a couple.
Okay. And the next question basically is coming in from Michigan, and they ask, for an IC related to a groundwater plume that has been implemented by a court and not the traditional approaches, how can an evaluation as described be implemented? Only parties to the case, which are the state and the PRP, can petition the court for anything, not just the IC. And as such, there is no opportunity to ask the questions presented in the five-year review evaluation.
Hmm, interesting. So the IC is that there's some court ordered restriction on a PRP by the court. That's what it sounds like.
No, I think we would still go through an evaluation process to see what's in place and, you know, how effective it is. And if there are some questions about some possible breaches or some issues with it, then we have to decide whether we can really do anything about it because of the situation with the court. Possibly maybe we could petition the court. I have no idea about that. Or think of other ways to make it more effective. Maybe it's just an educational component.
And I would think we would be able to get our hands on what the court order says.
Right. I was assuming we could get that and then look it over.
Yep. Okay. All right. Well, in the interest of time, since we're coming on at approximately 10 minutes past our scheduled end time, I'm going to move forward with the closeout for today's session. So I believe you guys left off on slide number 40, which was your resources slide. And if you don't have any comments on the resources before we end things, I'll remind everyone how they can download a number of documents that were discussed throughout today's presentation on the additional resources page before we close things out. We've gone through questions, so before we officially close out and I give everybody instructions on how to provide feedback, how to get a copy of the materials and the resources, as well as how to get confirmation messages for their participation today, Dante and Sherry, would you like to make any closing statements?
I was just thinking that the one thing on my mind was making sure people have access to the various documents besides just that they were on the CLUIN webinar today. And the another resource, if you can't necessarily find something online, but it was in our presentation, you have an EPA, you have a title, you have a call number and stuff. EPA has national as well, it's probably regional, information resource hotlines and specialists and stuff. There's an EPA library in each of the regional offices as well as headquarters, and the public can contact the library, and if you give them the call number and the exact title, they can find it for you.
And I guess my closing statement would be that that I hope, you know, people have learned something, but just one of the most important things to take back is that there's a whole network of people and resources there available to help you through any of the questions you have, and hopefully you can remember that and use us as needed.
Okay, great. Thank you. With that, I'm going to ask everyone to move on to slide number 42, which is the final slide in today's materials. You'll see a few things, links on slide number 42. The first one is a link to our additional resources page. If you were to click that link, that'll bring you to a collection of files that have been pulled together for today's session, including not only the PowerPoint presentation, but a variety of documents which on ICs, recommended evaluations when it's a supplement to the 5-year review guidance, recommended contents for the IC-IAP. There's a number of documents up there. If you're not at a computer with internet access, the link to additional resources is available on the seminar homepage. So the same page that you were emailed in your confirmation messages and reminders for today, there will be a link on the or button on the left side that says links. It also appears at the bottom of the page under the text link to additional resources. And so you can go back to that page at any time and, again, download the presentation material as well as a variety of these other documents. The second link that's referenced on our final slide number 42, is a link to our short feedback form. It takes about 2 minutes to fill that out, and we do ask that you take a minute to do that and complete a form for us. I read each and every one of these comments, so if you thought that this was a valuable training, you'd like to see more offered for free like this through CLUIN, please fill out the feedback form. That's the only way we can ensure to deliver training programs like this. If you are looking to receive credit for your participation today, while we don't necessarily issue CEUs or PDHs through CLUIN, you may be able to collect materials for today's session, including the slides and your registration, as well as a confirmation message once you submit feedback, and submit that to your crediting organization to receive credit for today's session. In order to receive that confirmation message of your participation today, you need to fill out the feedback form and check a box on the form that will allow you to submit your feedback and have an email sent to you for your own records. If you share the line with multiple individuals, each person will have the opportunity to sit down and fill out their own feedback form to get their own confirmation message. And that very same link to the feedback form is available on the seminar homepage, so if you can't do it right now, you can certainly come back at any point in time in the future to provide feedback. We will be recording and archiving this session. For approximately 1 to 2 weeks, you will automatically receive an email from me as soon as this session is available for free download and replay. But you're welcome to go to the CLUIN website and check out our current listing of archives if you'd like to browse what we already have available. And one final note, we recently joined the world of social media, so if you really want to find out about the latest training opportunities or resources like this, feel free to look for us on Facebook or Twitter. We're under EPA Cleanup Tech. You'll be able to find us and follow us in daily postings and tweets throughout those services. With that, I want to extend my thanks to the organizers from NARPM, as well as our presenters from Region 5 and Region 9 for putting together today's materials and providing a wonderful session. I hope everybody found it to be informative, and that I will either see you or hear from you on a future CLUIN seminar. This marks the formal conclusion for today's event. Again, thank you all. I hope you have a great rest of your day.